Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, 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 everyone. Today is December 4th, 2020. Today we'll be discussing part one of the epilogue, How to Outwit the Six Ghosts of Fear from the Thinking Grow Rich book. I am Taylor Delmas, one of the MCO interns studying accounting in FIU. Today I have with me Ajra.
Hello.
Ajra, announce yourself. You do this every time.
This is Ajra. I work at MCO. I'm also, I graduated from FIU this past spring with a major in construction management and a minor in marketing. So, hello, everyone.
Alrighty, and then we also have two co-hosts and guests with us today. Please announce yourself.
Good morning. My name is John Smith. I'm a marketing major at Florida Memorial University, and I'm an intern at MCA Construction.
And you're what?
Question for me?
What was the last part of your introduction? I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. I said I'm an intern at MCO Construction.
Alrighty. And then Sharnay?
Good morning. I'm Sharnay David. I'm a recent graduate from Kwajalein University, majoring in fashion design, and I am currently the digital designer of Aubrey & Co.
Ooh, nice, nice, nice. All right, so today our discussion is going to be on half of the chapter of the epilogue because as I was reading it, there's so much information and there's so much to be discussed about in the first half, and to try to jam-pack it in one show would be a disservice to the book and to ourselves. So let's start with the beginning of the chapter. Usually going to start about how you feel, but I'm not going to. So... the opening statements of the chapter really, basically discusses the reason why you have to analyze your fears and understand them. So what he puts it as, to master the principles of Think and Grow Rich, you have to clear out all enemies. And the main three enemies that he has talked about or he starts with, indecision, doubt, and fear. So... basically, from this chapter, from what I've gotten, is that fear leads to indecision, which leads to doubt. Fear cripples how you decide, and then it leads to doubting yourself. So you either you do it and you mess it up, or you don't do it. So how do you guys feel about that statement that he put there in the beginning of the chapter? That the three main enemies are indecision, fear, and doubt.
How do I feel about that? It makes a lot of sense what he's saying because doubt, a lot of people that want to commit to certain things and certain goals naturally have doubts about what it is they're trying to do. And I think it's, like, normal, even though it can stop you from committing to whatever it is, but like it is definitely crippling to have doubts because that just literally ruins everything, and that's where everything goes downhill from there when you have doubts about what it is you're supposed to be committed to or what you're supposed to be doing. And fear as well, fear is a big factor in everyone's life. Everyone has a fear of something, so yeah.
Sharnay and John.
Thank you. Okay. I'll piggyback off of what she just said. It also made me think about the chapter of auto-suggestion because doubt and fear and indecision, all of those things are suggested to us every day, every single day, subconsciously. And we don't really realize that it's being projected onto us. And so, you know, most times it's not even what we want to do. Most times it's not even what we actually feel. It's something that's being taught to us or something that's being told to us or something that we see or something that we hear. And that's influencing our decisions to now be doubtful and to be indecisive and to fear. So I agree with what he says. And I like how that kind of tied in with something that was spoken about earlier in the book.
Yeah. And that's dope that you said that, because me, Gunna, John, and Ajwa, every time we read, we're always like the next chapter, literally the tie-in to the previous one. And that kind of leads to, like, the next point into the epilogue, is that fear, whether it be fear works with thought impulses. Thought impulses, whether it be positive or negative, are just, like you said, subconsciously in the back of your mind, where your creative imagination and your infinite intelligence work together with you. But because those thought impulses are random, and if you don't master them, if you don't control them, then 9 times out of 10, what it will pick out to work from, to make physical, could be negative if you let fear control, or it could be positive if you learn to control it through auto-suggestion. John?
Yes, definitely. So my feedback about this chapter is basically, I feel like, you know, when indecision or doubt or even fear arises, it's mainly because, you know, we're deciding to, you know, take a next step, step out of our comfort zones. And I would say, you know, a lesson that I really learned from these three ghosts of fear is that, you know, the longer you take to make the decision to move forward or, you know, embrace change, the harder it'll be, like, when you actually decide to make that choice. So, you know, my advice would just to be to, you know, overlook fear. Like it says, whatever you tell yourself, whatever you feed your mind, that's exactly what you're going to get from it. So, you know, just, you know, being, I would say, you know, comfortable enough to just go through it and knowing that, you know, what you're going to get on the next side is what you always pray for.
Yeah. And then, it also ties, well, the beginning of the chapter, as I was saying, it always ties back to just, like, what you feed yourself. It's like, don't be mad if all you eat is cake. Like, don't be mad that nothing ever came true or none of your dreams came true or none of your riches were accomplished if all you thought was, oh, but that or but this. And that's one thing that he tries to teach throughout the book consistently, is to feed yourself positive thoughts so you can translate them into something more positive. All right, so thank you guys. That was actually pretty dope. Going back to thought impulses, to clear that part up, is just that you have control of your thought pulses with auto-suggestion. So when you learn to control your thought impulses through auto-suggestion, then you give your subconscious mind better things to feed off of. If you feed your subconscious mind that you can, you will. But if you feed it that you cannot, then you will not, 9 times out of 10. But it also takes a whole bunch of something else to overcome it. It's not easy. And the thing that I love to put in this chapter is that it takes time. And feel free to jump in, you all, whenever you feel comfortable to, but he deliberately feeds in. It's just like he never says any of this comes in the blink of an eye. Like it comes through this. Like when he went through auto suggestion, he said over and over again, it takes time. Like it's constant. It's constant feeding. It's constant nurturing.
I literally was just literally 5 minutes before I got on the call, I was talking to my Morehouse brother about, it's just like the transition from being a student, like for 13 years, especially going to college, you kind of have this end goal. You have everything kind of set up for you. You already have the classes that you have to take, and you know that you're going to get a diploma. But when you transition from that lifestyle for all those years into now, you having so many options, going back to what you were saying about it takes time, like, that's basically the space that I'm in right now. It's just realizing that, you know, if I do want certain things, I do have to be mindful of what I digest, whether it's food, whether it's information, whether it's music. and just be, mm-hmm. like, open to understanding that, like, the old ways of doing things, the old music I used to listen to, the old conversations I used to have, the things I used mm-hmm. to indulge in, that's going to take to kind of get out of my system and not to be frustrated mm-hmm. or feel like I'm not, like, doing things a certain way, but to still just, like you were saying, consistently just replacing those things with more conducive things. So I 100% agree, and that's basically the story of my life right now as we speak.
And then I also love how, like, because, like, we're going to, like, with this chapter is also kind of, like, summing up everything that we read. A lot of it is, especially with your own, especially with the epilogue that I've seen so far, is that it takes a lot of self-reflection. Like, even through every chapter, you have to literally, like, stop in the middle of your reading and think about, do I, like, feed myself negative thoughts? Is my mastermind group or the people that mm-hmm. I carry around the most positive? And are they feeding?
No, I was saying I love that.
Yeah. So, like, it takes a lot of self-reflection. Like, I feel like when I was in the mastermind group, sometimes your mastermind group, he also tells you to reflect on those around you, speaking to you, and what is subconsciously being dragged inside. And it's just like, is that one friend that's always talking about other people or always questioning your goals or being negative? Is that the person that you want to carry around you? And then it also reflects on you, where is that one person, are you the person that's always questioning someone's goals? Like, as I was reading this book, I have a cousin who's slowly becoming an entrepreneur, and I'm a person who's a very worrisome. I'm not a very entrepreneurial spirit, so when she tells me ideas, I question them. And after reading this chapter, I've learned that if someone throws an idea out, if it's not 100% the worst idea I've ever heard, encourage it. Don't question it or belittle it, because when that little spark of an idea or that thought impulse that he speaks about, when it comes out, if you nurture it, you make her feel better, and then 9 times out of 10, she will accomplish her goal, whether it be bad or not. And now she's doing very well for herself. So as soon as I stopped questioning her, because I realized that I was that key pin in whether she moved forward or not. If she feels like, oh, Taylor is not going to ride with her on it, then it's obviously not a good idea. Not that they weren't good ideas, it's just that I'm not an entrepreneurial spirit, so, like, I kind of, like, downed on her. So, like, as soon as I stopped, after reading this, as soon as I stopped doing that, now she has 3 different businesses and she's thriving. So I realized that I was also that person. So this book has honestly helped me and, like, people around me in a certain way. Pretty dope. I got a Michael Kors bag out of it.
Yep.
And she got her credit business off the wall. And I helped her through it all. And then she bought me a Michael Kors.
Yeah.
Ah! It was amazing. It was a truly humbling experience. God is good. Somebody finished a line. God is good.
All the time.
All the time, period.
All the time.
I'm just crying thinking about that.
Woo.
Okay. Sorry, Sharnay, because you've never really done the blog talk show with me, but I'm a very informal person. All right, so before we get into the first, because I think today we're going to only discuss the first 2 basic fears, the 6th basic fears that Napoleon Hill outlines is the fear of poverty, which he describes as the most prominent fear, the most debilitating one, the fear of criticism, the fear of ill health, the fear of a loss of love of someone, the fear of old age, and the fear of death. Now, we're only going to speak today about poverty and the fear of criticism, but to you all, as persons, which one do you feel is your most debilitating fear for yourself? Because even if the fear of poverty is the most debilitating for the world, what are you feeling yourself without even, like, truly going into, like, deep thought about it? What is your most debilitating fear that you feel?
I'll go. If those are the options, what did it say? Poverty?
Poverty, criticism, ill health, loss of love of someone, old age, and death.
You were going to have to choose one.
Yeah, choose what you feel.
Well, my main one that first popped in my head was fear of poverty.
Mm-hmm.
Because it kind of sounds weird that I'm saying it. I'm not talking about poverty in the world, as in on a worldly basis, like people suffering. I'm talking about myself. I don't know if I'm thinking in the right context about poverty. I've always had a fear of not being successful and not seeing myself where I want to be. So, like, I can't see myself being in poverty, in a sense. Like, I don't want to be stuck in the same position. I want to elevate. So me not being able to reach it right away, that's kind of like a fear to me. Mm-hmm. It's a growing process. It's a stepping stone process. So the fear of not being able to obtain things and not being successful and me thinking, you know, what if I am not able to, like, pay my bills or, like, all of that. That kind of plays into it because I don't want to end up on the street.
That's the type of poverty I'm thinking about. That's what your parents tell you. Like, you're going to end up like a man on 79. Like,
yeah, I don't. That's a fear of mine. I don't homeless ever. Or I don't want to be never not money. So it's like
when you drive up and you see a homeless man on the cross your heart and you pass him a dollar.
Yeah.
And it's a both ways.
That's a big thing for me, like, because I see homeless people on the, like, at the supermarkets all the time, and I'm like, I pray I never have to do that, because it's, like, reality is, like, anybody, like, any one of us, there's people who've had millions and lost it all, and, like, they ended up homeless, so, like, it's crazy how things happen in this world, so poverty is one of my main. And there's different ways to think of poverty too, because it could be poverty in the, like, in your spirit, in your mind. You could be lacking in, like, mentally, physically, like, poverty. Yeah, so that's my main.
And that's one thing we're gonna get about.
I have a question for you, Ajwa.
Mhm. Yeah, go ahead.
So you said I can agree with you with the fear of poverty being, you know, one of the top ones for me also, but. Like, was that a fear for you, like, I would say, like, throughout your whole life, or at what age did that fear started for you? Like, when did you realize, like, you know, you feared poverty, like,
what experience you had with money? Yeah, that fear started for me when I came to college. You know, when you reach that age, okay, you're on your own now. And you have to learn to defend for yourself because my parents are very overprotective. They've always done everything for me. So up until I came here, like, they would provide everything for me. And not saying that if something happens to me now that they won't be there to help me. They're always there to help me. But it started when I was in college because now you're, like, thinking about, okay, I got to make a way for myself. I can't just be dependent on my parents for the rest of my life. So that fear started thinking, like, what? Successful in enough, and I have to be dependent on them. That's kind of like poverty to me because, like,
oh my god, that just dawned on me. Like, what if I have to live with my parents?
Yeah, what if, like, to me, that is kind of like poverty because, like, you're dependent on other people instead of being independent for yourself. So, like, I was thinking the first thing I was thinking, oh, what if I don't get a job up here? What if I don't finish my classes? I'm wasting my parents' money. Like, what if I end up on the street? So, like, you have that fear. In so, like, when I was in college, because you don't want to be that person that you're just flying through college and, like, no care in the world, not trying to, like, start up for yourself, not starting to, like, look for your own place, trying to figure out where you want to head and where you want to go, especially in college, because people start out in college and they have no idea what they want to do with their life, and they're just, like, blindsided when they get hit with reality. Like, after you finish college, it really hits you, like, you are no longer a student. You're out in the real world, and it's going to hit you if you don't prepare. Because it slowly starts to dwindle down. Like, your parents are not going to, once you hit college, some kids get kicked out when they're a teenager. They start to have to, like, do work when they're a teenager. But thankfully, I have parents that want to do all. But so it's like.
Well, thanks.
Honestly, before you graduate, you guys, since you guys are still in college, make sure you have a solid plan, because sometimes it's just like, oh, I graduated this year, from FIU, nobody thought a whole pandemic was going to hit. So it's like, okay, like under pressure, fear to find a job. I don't want to be, not have money. Like going back to poverty, I don't want to not have money. I don't want to be able not to defend for myself. And being that it was a pandemic, it's even harder to find a job because you know how it is as a student when you're looking for a job, how hard it is when you graduate because people always think, oh, I have a degree. A degree doesn't equate to you finding a job at all.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure you, like, you know, figure everything out before you leave because then you'll be guessing and then that's how you end up on the street.
Got you.
That's my answer to that question, John.
Thank you.
That's a great answer. And then for John, what's your most debilitating fear off the top of the dome?
I would say the fear probably would be the at the top of the list for me.
Yeah, so I think we spoke earlier this week. I think you sent the application.
Did you guys hear me?
Poverty?
Yeah, the fear of poverty.
Why?
I would say just mainly because, you know, it's kind of a male thing, being a man. All men, you know, want to be independent, don't want to really depend on anyone. And then, you know, it's a part of, you know, growing up. And then I read in this book called Acres of Diamond from Miss McNeil. You know, just one of the things that they said in there, I always was questioning it. And he said, a boy becomes a man when he owns his first home. So, you know, that would be a question that either one of you guys could answer if you guys, you know, father. I never tell him anything about that. Or, you know, I probably can ask Miss McNeil. But, you know, that was just something that stood out to me. And, you know, I just feel like, you know, success should be, you know, inevitable, and it's not here yet. So, fear of poverty definitely keeps me going.
Oh. And then for you, Trent?
Pardon?
The same as everyone else, just the fear of poverty. Wow. That, which I was just going back and forth, that just, I'm over here like, wow, because I felt that. I felt all of that. And even answering your question, John, about when did you feel that, I feel like for me, that was always what I was taught from a very young age of just living in the projects and coming home to the lights being off and having to live with family members and friends and stuff like that. I was taught that you don't need to be doing this and this should not be your life. So because I feared poverty, I was such a hustler. I was such a go-getter. I had this mentality like, I got to go get it to the point where I got everything that I've ever wanted, especially in college when I was pursuing my career in fashion. I surpassed my dreams that I had when I was 15 years old, but even though because that I did that and the fear of poverty encouraged me to do that, it also has a flip side to it where you're not even open to certain things because you have an end goal in mind. Or, you know, you're afraid of making other decisions because you're like, no, I got to be this by this age, so that means I can't do this. But what if God didn't have you that be bold? Like, what if he wanted you to actually just meet up with somebody at the library and boom, that's your business partner that you think, you know, but doing it your way, you're thinking a certain thing. So that is a very deep one. And what you were saying earlier about having that self-analysis, I had to highlight a few of the symptoms of the fear of poverty because I'm like, dang, I didn't know how to verbalize it. I just thought like, oh, I just don't want to be broke. I didn't know that it was an actual, like, thing. And the symptoms that I was having was because of it. So, yeah, that was deep. I never had to, like, I guess, acknowledge it. I never had to acknowledge it until I read this chapter. And even hearing you guys speak on it just kind of set it in stone even more. Like, yeah, that's a fear.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I know for me, because you might as well, not such pretty dope, can't cap. Because to come from an impoverished beginning and to pursue fashion is very brave.
Yeah.
It's not an easy industry, and that's very brave. So I commend you on that one, though, Kat. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I know for me, we might as well go into the fear of poverty, because the fear of poverty for me and myself is one of my most debilitating. Not to say, and then one thing about it is, he said you can have, one thing I like the way he put it in the beginning of this chapter is that you can have one that is your most debilitating fear, but you can also have multiple fears, but they're just not as heavy and they're not as daunting. So I know for me it's the fear of poverty, but it's not, and it's weird because the way you said it was like the fear of being impoverished and the fear of poverty and growing up impoverished is just that I grew up poor too. Like I grew up in out of town. I grew up like 15 minutes away from where MCO is. I grew up living with my grandmother, traveling from like house to house, from going home and sometimes the lights being off or the water off. So I grew up impoverished, and I grew up where like some Christmases are a little dry and some Christmases got a little twinkle. So I grew up that, but I've never been afraid to be poor, because I've always been, I've never, like, the fear of poverty isn't, the fear of monetary poverty has never daunted on me. Like, I've been in college. The wide awakening came at me fast when like, I paid my insurance. I paid all my bills, and I had no money left. And I don't like asking my parents for money, because like, that's sort of, like, independence, like you talked about before. I don't ask my parents for money. So I literally had to, like, grasp all my straws. Like, the one reason I don't have a fear of, like, monetary impoverishment is because I've always learned from growing up impoverished that there's many ways that you can get something. Like, I've always been that kid to sit back and watch. So the fear of, like, monetary poverty has never done it to me because I've always had a job. Like, I don't think I've moved with the fear of being in poverty, but I've moved knowing that if you don't do this, then something else will happen. So I've always made sure I had me a little penny in the back seat so I don't have to worry and I don't have to be afraid. Like when I was in college and I was at FIU and I don't know how or what happened, but I ended up having like $0 in my bank account for like 2 weeks. But I knew that because I was on scholarship, I had me like a free meal at the thing, or because I worked at Starbucks, I get a free meal every day. Uh-huh. So I've always known how to make little things work or make tight things work. So the fear of monetary impoverishment is not what I'm most afraid of. It's just the fear of like poverty within like your spirit and your mind.
Mm-hmm.
Growing up, I've seen what happens when lose their spirit or when they lose their like their will. Like I've seen my mom when she lost her sister and she like, oh my God, I commend my mom for even like making it.
Mm-hmm.
Like at first she lost her father. Couple years later, she lost her best friend, her sister, and then she lost her mother.
Thanks.
And then her whole family started falling apart. So I slowly saw my family and I saw my mother lose her spirit and lose her will. So that's what I'm most afraid of. I'm most afraid of you can be, because I've always learned that, and my dad's always taught me this, is that you can be successful, you can be unhappy. My main fear is to be impoverished in my spirit and my unhappiness. Like, I don't want to do all this and be successful, but I'm unhappy at the end of the day, and I hate what I do. Like, I've seen multiple family members have a good job where they can make their bills and they have money, but they're at the end of the day, they don't want to go to work because they don't like it anymore, or they're not happy.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's what I like in this chapter is, before you can get to the fear of poverty, you have to understand, what do you deem as riches? Because riches are opposite of poverty. So what do you deem to be rich? Like, in the beginning of this chapter, and I'm not going to lie to y'all, when I first started reading this book, I didn't want to read it because I thought this was another, like, get-rich book. I'm not going to lie. Like, I thought, I was, and want to, because sometimes the way my voice is set up is kind of,
That's you.
I thought Get Rich book. I thought there's another book on how to get all in your pocket, but not to teach you how to live and to learn. Now that I know it's a book to teach how to live and learn, I'm more open to read it. But when I first read it, I didn't want to read it because all he was talking about was monetary riches, monetary desire. But my main desire in life is to find a lane and a career choice that makes me happy, to be happy. Because you can get, to me, even though I grew up poor and I know how to live within my means because that's what I've learned growing up, but I've seen people get off of work and just not have an ounce of, like, joy or happiness in their being because they have to work mm-hmm. or they don't have a choice. So, like, for me, the fear of, like, losing your spiritual, like, your spirit and losing your will is just, like, the main thing for me. And that's one thing that he goes through in his fear of poverty is that first you have to identify what riches are to you to impede poverty. Because one thing that I love that he puts throughout this book multiple times is that he never deems riches to be monetary. He says that certain people's riches can become out of monetary. Some people's riches are to attain a certain number of a certain thing up to my mouth is stuck to attain a certain value of something, but he never goes out and explicitly deems that riches only equal money. And that's when I started to really like this book. How about you all?
Same. When I first heard about the book, I'm like, why am I reading this book? Like, I was already annoyed. I'm like, you know, but then as you realize what the book is actually about,
mm-hmm.
it's like it's feeding your mind in a sense, like not only about, because there are parts in the book where they want you to obtain riches, obviously,
mm-hmm.
but they're kind of giving it to you from a mental perspective of how you can be all-rounded in every aspect in everything that you do, not just to be rich, because there are people in the world that's just money hungry, but
mm-hmm.
it's like edifying your mind and teaching you not only about being rich within as in currency, but rich in within yourself, within your mind, and how you think and how you do things. So
mm-hmm.
yeah.
I think for me, I've had to read this book, and I haven't read it all the way through, but this is probably like my fifth time picking this book up in the span of like 3 years ever since I met Miss Anne, and it's like
mm-hmm.
it has so different meanings. Like what you were just, Taylor, was that just you just, that was just talking about
yeah.
like the spiritual richness? Okay. So first of all, you snap. Like I'm over here, girl, my soul. Like, wow, that was perfectly said, but that's exactly how I was feeling. But I didn't like, I felt it, but then it switched back to the poverty because it's like when you know that that's all you know, like that's all you're able to perceive. So the fact that like you saw it from that angle, and that's why I love this book, and it kind of took me some time to kind of get into the book because it's like one sentence will have you read a sentence like five times because you're like, what are you? It's like there's so many hidden meanings in one sentence, and you're trying to apply it. If you're like an introspective person, you're trying to apply it to yourself. You're trying to take things apart, and that kind of took a lot of time, and I was like, all right, I don't got time for this. Let me just, you know, I was, again, I was in the mentality of something that wasn't, you know, for the long haul, but hearing you break it down like that was just, like, proof, again, that, you know, it is important for us to kind of, especially when we're reading this book, to kind of be open to the different perspectives that is being presented and to actually, like you said, like understand the riches that we desire. Because when I first read it in the first chapter, it was like, how much money do you have? I was like, I don't really want money, but I want money, but I just want to be happy. But I could use $10,000. So I was like stuck. And when I get stuck, I'm like, I don't want to do it because I feel like it's kind of coming against my integrity because I don't want to read a book that's telling me to set my mind on a certain dollar amount. But what if that's not what I'm supposed to be doing? So I was really just really pulling everything apart. But just the more I kept reading, it kept also reminding me, like, you don't have to have this this regular script of I want this amount of money by this time and I'm going to give this. You can kind of change it to fit your personal needs, and even including like I want a sense of peace. You know, that could be something that could be within the formula as well. So, again, thank you, Taylor, for encouraging me to kind of look at it that way instead of just getting into the mindset of what I'm used to perceiving things as.
Yeah. And that's what I'd be talking about when I say, like, it takes a sense of reflection. It's just, like, as I'm reading the book and, like, I'm forced to read it because Miss Anne wants us to do these blog talk shows, so I'm forced to keep reading, but... If I was in Barnes & Noble, I picked up the book and I read the first page, and it was like, "What? How much money do you want?" Money is not an option. Like, money, I speak about money. I've always had it. Like, I'm very, my cousin, as anti-Semitic as it sounds, she always says I'm Jewish with my money. It's just that I don't give it out, and I don't spend a lot. Like, a lot of my family knows me for spending money on them and not me. So it's like, when I was reading this book, it's just like, money has never been the most important to me. It's just that it's how I feel about going and how I wake up in the morning with the goal in mind. That's what I want for my future. That will make me rich inside. And then for you, John?
Yeah, my bad. Yeah, I'm still taken away by you guys' responses, because I would say, like, certain people feel like, especially, you know, attending to college, they feel like, you know, certain things that they be going through, it only feel like it's just them. But just hearing you guys' responses, I'd say, like, you know, that's some things that I've been, you know, going through right now. So, yeah, I'm really taking it all in right now, because this is, like, my first time back on the show in a while. So, yeah.
Miss Anne said you were hustling.
She's kind of right. She's kind of right. Stop hustling and start a business.
And that's dope. It's just like, and that's one thing that I've always come and really commended about you, Charnay, and like anyone else I've seen, like, start a business. And that's why I had to change my outlook on like entrepreneurship and taking risks when it came to my started her business and how I got my Michael Kors. Ooh. She's so pretty.
Girl.
I don't understand. I am a tote purse person. And then, because I help, because I'm really good at, like, back office work, and I'm really good at all the stuff. So she knows that I'm pursuing an accounting degree, and I helped her a lot with her credit business, and now she's making money off the woohoo. And then she was like, you supported me. You want a Michael Kors? And I'm like, yes, of course I want a Michael Kors. Like, what? what's the talking about?
I'm going to need to see this Michael Kors purse.
Girl,
when are you coming to the reunion in January?
And this is why I talk about monetary value has never been the most important, because it's the most basic Michael Kors bag, but because the feeling behind the bag just makes me so proud. I put, like, you know how Michael Kors has the little slits in it? I put that in my book as, like, a reminder to keep going. It's honestly amazing. Irregardless, Mr. Napoleon Hill, to go back to the book, he describes the fear of poverty as the most destructive force. And as we've seen, like, four people from different areas. I'm from poverty. He's Ajua from the Virgin Islands. John's from the Bahamas. And Trene, where are you from?
I'm from Tampa, Florida.
Tampa? Ew, Northern Florida? You're from Florida, Florida. I'm from Miami. City girls.
Hey. Literally.
But, like, four people from, like, different areas of, like, a southern region still have the same fear. Mm-hmm. And that's why he calls it the most destructive and the most debilitating. When he goes through this chapter, he, in the beginning, states that fear is only a state of mind.
That is true.
So let me be specific. I can't find it. Yeah. So he basically just says that fear is a state of mind, and that if you let it rule you, it will control you, but you can't control it. So, like, one thing that I feel like Sharnae did, she took her fear of poverty and used it as a go-getting factor instead of a debilitating factor, instead of saying, oh, I don't want to take this risk because I don't want to be poor. But you, when you move a certain way, you can do certain things, and that's one thing I will commend about you, because I couldn't do it. I'm not a risk taker. That's why I chose accounting and not finance. So I am so funny, period. First, you have to determine the riches that you seek, and like I feel like we've all done that. So to get over or to work with your fear of poverty, you have to first determine the fears, the riches that you seek, and along with the philosophies of the first 13 steps, you have to learn how to demand and command it. Then you have to understand where your fear of poverty came from, and that it's only a state of mind, and its only purpose is to paralyze your reason and be a detriment to your efforts. So when we go back to the first three enemies, is that fear leads to indecision, which leads to doubt. Mm-hmm. So when you let that fear of poverty start to control your deciding factor, like, oh, maybe I'm not going to apply for a business loan because maybe I won't make it and then I have a ton of debt. People, you can live with debt. Is it easy?
No.
But you can live with debt. Trump does it. I'll do it too. That's just debilitating, honestly. But, you know, tax evasion thing.
You know, you said something. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. What were you saying?
You said something about you have to demand it. And that, at first, I thought that meant, okay, I just got to affirm I'm this every day. I got to look at myself in the mirror, you know, but that only goes so far. And it made me think, okay, you know, how else can I demand this in my life? And I realized the only time I really started to truly see change, because you can only do so much by yourself, but the only time I truly saw change is when I started demanding it out of the people around me. Like, say, for instance, if I'm doing something and that person's not doing it, I'm like, okay, let me just move over to the side. Like, I started to kind of demand it out of my environment. Like, if I'm not receiving what I need to receive, I'm not going to shoot you down. I'm not going to make you feel bad. I'm not going to shun you, but I'm going to move away because I need to demand this. And if I consistently demand this out of my environment, I'm going to turn into my environment. So that was one of the, when you said that just triggered me, because I'm like, that has definitely been the biggest change, is when you start demanding it out of your environment. And on top of that, demanding it out of yourself.
Yeah, and that goes back to, like, the principles of, I believe, desire, auto-suggestion, and mastermind. It's like, it's everything that happens around you affects you, and it goes back into your subconscious mind. Like, little things such as, like, I grew up 15 minutes away. Like, literally, while we're doing the show, there's the Metro Road going behind. Growing up, I literally listened to the Metro Rail and the airplane chute all the time, so I'm never afraid of it. But I'm used to distractions in the back of my ears, so I know how to work with them. Like, literally, while I do my homework, I have to have noise behind me. So it's like that background noise does affect you.
Wow, I'm the complete opposite.
Same. You got to study.
Like, you have to be extremely quiet. Extremely quiet.
If I don't hear nobody yelling behind me, I don't. When I have to do homework, I have to, because now from COVID, now that I'm forced to stay in my dorm, I can't go to Starbucks.
Mm-hmm.
Before, I used to go study at Starbucks because there's so much noise
and so much things going on
that I learned how to focus. Because growing up, when you live 2 seconds away from the Metro Rail and American Airlines,
here's
5 seconds away, all you hear is noise. And then you got three black people arguing in the background. You have to learn with your environment. So it's either you change it or you work with it.
Mm-hmm.
So Sharnae, I commend you. Like, you gotta watch. I can't believe y'all can work in science. Oh my god.
I said.
Oh my geez. Yeah, I commend you, because that goes back to the principle of suggestion and mastermind group. Like, I had to change how I come off to people, and then you also have to change people that you keep around yourself. Like, if that person ain't doing nothing for you, then there's no reason to keep them. It's like, it's like a leech. And what are you taking something from me when I give it relationship is not symbiotic at this point. And then
yeah, that's
thank you.
For real.
Mhm. And then so you have the demand that you get to command it with the principles of the first 13, and then you have to understand where that fear of poverty comes from. And you have to understand it's only there to paralyze and detriment you. So I understand what my type of fear of poverty comes from. And but for everyone else to go over it and to work with your fear, you have to understand where it comes from. As little as it may be or as big as it may be, if you don't understand why you're scared to be poor or where it comes from, then you won't understand how to leave it. Like one thing he says in the book is that he spoke about one instance where this boy ended up in the penitentiary because as he grew up, all his mother would say to him is that you're going to end up in the penitentiary by the time you're 20. And he ended up in a correction facility by the time he was 17. Because that's all that is in the back of your mind. You have to understand why you did something or why you're afraid to do something to work or move against it. And I thought that was pretty dope because he uses irregular examples, and I really love that. And then once you get through that reason and you find out how it's debilitating you, so the symptoms he talks about, let's go over the symptoms real quick. So the symptoms of the fear of poverty is indifference, indecision, doubt, worry, overcaution, procrastination. So for y'all, which one do you think is your biggest fear of poverty? Indifference, indecision, doubt, worry, overcaution, or procrastination?
Indecision for me, because that stops me from doing a lot of things. Mm-hmm. Indecision. So I'm not so much. What was the other one?
Indifference, doubt, worry,
procrastination. I've had a problem with procrastination all my life, but I'm learning now to do things on time. So that one was not really a fail for me. So yeah, it's indecision mostly because I'm very indecisive, very
kind of.
Yeah. So yeah, that's one for me.
John and Charney.
I would say indecision for me. Because I would say, you know, just basically, just like you said earlier, I think it was Ajwa, you know, just being a dependent of your parents or, you know, just them doing everything for you. And then, you know, coming off to college, especially coming from the Bahamas, you know, where it's really tough over there. So just making, you know, huge decisions on my own, I would say, you know, it's kind of scary sometimes. So I kind of tend to be indecisive, but that's something I'm working on.
Mhm. And then Trini.
Hello.
Okay.
I think she got. Is she still there?
I don't know.
She's
still there. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I'll go over mine while Trini reconnects. I feel like for me, one could say all of them is a fear because these certain fears don't always come from solely the fear of poverty, but growing up, I will say the one fear I had from a fear of just, like, almost everything is that procrastination. Whether it be, like, procrastinating from a decision or procrastinating from doing something, whether it be positive or negative, has really debilitated me because I'm so scared of what the effect of something will be that I'll push it off until the last minute, or I'll say it doesn't matter, or I'll wait. And I feel like, as he describes it, the habit of putting off until tomorrow, which could have been done last year, spending enough time and creating alibis and excuses to have done the job, the symptom is closely related to overcaution, doubt, and worry, literally me. Refusal to accept responsibility when it can be avoided, willingness to compromise rather than putting off a stiff fight, compromising with difficulties instead of harnessing and using them as stepping stones to advancement, bargaining with life for a penny instead of demanding prosperity, opulence. If and when overtaken by failure, instead of burning all bridges and making a retreat possible, weakness and a total lack of self-confidence, definiteness of purpose, self-control. Basically, people like 50 different definitions. he basically gave someone who makes excuses no excuses, and that's kind of dope. See, because I just love the way he wrote the book. Honestly, if I was a big nonfiction reader, I would have finished it by now, but not me. But yeah, it's just like, for me, is I will literally put something off until the last minute because I'm so scared about what happened. And it is overcaution and worry. Like, and it's certain fears. It has taken a toll on my health because I do have, like, anxiety from it. So, like, every once in a blue moon when I have to make a really big decision, my chest hurts so bad. Like, you can't breathe.
I've had bad anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
Terrible.
And a lot of people don't realize that they have it until, like, it's to the last point when your doctor tells you to just calm down and you're just like, sir, ain't nothing calm over here. But yeah.
Hello.
Hey, Trinae.
Welcome back.
Did I go?
Yeah.
Welcome back.
But yeah, so we were just discussing the symptoms. We're discussing the last part of the fear of poverty, which is the symptoms. So we're going to ask you, what do you think is your biggest symptom from the fear of poverty? Because you can have more than one, but what do you feel like stands out the most? Indifference, indecision, doubt, worry, or overcaution, and procrastination?
Like I was saying before, it was a mixture of indecision and procrastination, but it's not that I'm indecisive. It's just that it's the procrastination that feeds the indecision. So it's like you were saying, I think I got the end part of what you were saying about the, about like you just, like you're being afraid of the outcome. And because of going back to like poverty mindset, like, because I've always had this go-getter mindset and I've had parents that I appreciate it. I love that they did this because it built up my willpower, but they taught me how to be a performer. So I always had to be on. I always had to be doing. I always had to be the best. And so sometimes that can be draining. And, you know, with the procrastination, because I have that mindset, like, I always have to be the best because I have, like, accolades and accomplishments that shows, like, I've done things that are good. I procrastinate and say, like, oh, I don't really have to put too much emphasis or like, work into it because I'm going to do good anyways type mentality. And
oh my
I didn't
God.
Realize that once I started. Huh?
Sorry, you made me realize that happened to me.
Girl, it's insane. It's a good thing, and that's why, you know, even to this day, it's like I try not to make it a negative thing, but it definitely has some shadow qualities about it. And just from there, I'm just like, because I know that I can do it, that makes me not do it even more. It makes no sense, but especially now that I'm verbalizing it, it's like it makes no sense. But it's like I'm afraid because I don't want to mess up because I've always performed and I've always done my best. And I just kind of push it off into the last minute. And then, like, when it says that you kind of, like, you bargain with, like, life for a penny. And so I go into this mentality of, oh, I pushed it off, so I like to work under pressure. Like, what? Why is that your reality? Why do you want that? Why do you have to feel like you have to go hard every time you do something? Or why do you have to, you know what I'm saying? Like, why can't you demand prosperity in a healthy way of just, putting out tasks and doing a little bit every day. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's really just a mindset about, like, what you were saying. It's a mentality thing. And I realized that just that kind of was fueled by my childhood. But with this book, it's definitely been encouraging me to uproot a lot of that stuff and demand that it leave me and just kind of, like, refill it up with the truth and with better habits.
Yeah. It's, the self-reflection just goes hard. Let's be real. It really goes hard. And thank
for
you for
real.
That.
Leave you in here. Yeah, you're welcome.
Yes. And then we're going to get to the last part, which is the last part of today's episode, which is money talks. I don't know if everyone's read this part, but what I got from it is that you are no better than the person next to you. Like, I'm no better than the homeless man I saw today. The only difference is that I have money and he doesn't. that doesn't make him, like, sometimes people treat homeless people as if they're, like, lepers. Like, as if they're, like, below the earth. And I've seen it. It's just, like, my friend was like, oh, my God, he's homeless. And I was like,
yeah,
just a man on the street, bro. Like, chill out. Or, like, I was at work one time, and I will never forget this. And this one of my coworkers was like, oh, we'll give them this food for free. And I was like, yes, a nice thing to do, but I'm not going to walk up to someone and assume they're homeless by the way they're dressed. And she was like, I know they're homeless. And I was like, well, I don't know they're homeless, so I'm not going to assume they're homeless. And get dodged in the face. It's not going to happen to me. Not in South Florida. It's just that one thing I really liked about this section of the chapter is that the pedestal that we put money on. I think I wrote like a synopsis on it a little bit. It's just like the way money is perceived and used for, whether it be for responsibilities or whether money is being used for responsibilities or it's been seen as a status symbol, is exactly why he wrote the book the way he did. A lot of the reasons why he wrote the book about monetary riches in the beginning is to draw people in. Well, from what I got from this second chapter, is the reason why he started out with a monetary idea in the beginning is that because that's what most people need or want. That's what most people believe will help them attain a better life is money. So when you start out with money, but then you get to the root of what you need to attain money and or everything else around it, then you can have a better sort of life. So that's one thing I really loved about this section. And it was like he literally put that at the end when he talks about the homeless man or the man who lost his job and goes and down the street seeing people with money. And he was like, the only difference between you and that man is not a quality of life. It's just you are on two different socioeconomic levels.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, like, that's why I feel like sometimes I don't hold money to the same standard in that way, because it's just you're literally not, it doesn't make you smarter than me. Money doesn't make you smarter than me. Money doesn't make you better than me. It just puts us at two different socioeconomic levels. And that's all it is. That's how I've always held it.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. That just, girl, all of us. I feel like just this conversation alone got me over here ready to tackle all these demons who claim, you know, a lot of the things over my mind. And if that's really what it is, like, mm-hmm. you know, but again, when you're taught something, you know, and you're taught it and you trust the people that taught it to you, you think mm-hmm. that that's what it is. But when you get older and you have more experiences and those experiences give you access to new information, you're like, hold on, wait, that's not really as important as I thought it was, or that's not really what it is for me. It might be like that for you, but it's not like that for me. And just hearing you say that just confirmed. Just thank you, girl. Like, oh my gosh, you're cool. I like you.
Oh, thank you. I like you too. Oh. I don't know. How do you guys feel about the money talk section yourself?
The section that you just spoke on with how you view money. Pretty much the same. Like, the first thing that popped in my head when you said that, I don't know why, because it's one of those popular quotes or one of those popular things that people always say, where they say, treat the, I don't know who said it, but mm-hmm. treat the CEO with the same respect as the janitor.
Mm-hmm.
You treat people on the, like, literally on the same level. And as you're talking about that, I felt bad because the other day, like, I don't support homeless people, like mm-hmm. I said, because it could pretty much be any of us at any
mm-hmm.
So I don't hold any words them or anything, but literally like last week I went to the ATM and then a homeless person walked up to me and they asked a question and I answered and then I went to do something and I came back again and she saw me with money in my hand and she already received money from somebody else and she was asking me if I have a dollar to spare. I said, no, because that money was to pay my rent.
Mm-hmm.
And then she, like, was trying to walk up to me, like, And I'm like, were you about to get ran? I don't know, because I had money in my hand. Like, why are you walking towards me?
Why are you walking with money in your hand?
Yeah, so it's like,
offline, but
no, yeah.
Just etiquette.
But, yeah, like I said, don't scorn them or anything. But, like, sometimes, you know, I wonder, too, about, like, even though I have a fear of being homeless or, like, being, like, same thing with poverty and mm-hmm. everything, I'm like, I'm wondering to myself too sometimes. This is, I'm going off topic, sorry, but
this whole discussion has been off topic. Let's see where it's me.
Yeah, but like, I'm just wondering to myself, like, I feel like, I don't even know how to word it. Let me know, let me not get into that. I'm going to stick to what I was just saying. Yeah, like, so I treat people the same way how they want to be treated, I guess you should say. Or, like, if I see somebody that's in need or in help of something, regardless if I say no, that's not my real intention. Because, honestly, if I don't have it at the moment, I really don't.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, not to say that I don't help or, like, I don't want to treat people on this level. It's just that sometimes you got to deal with yourself. But that's it. It's for, like, how do you... Everybody has to, at the end of the day, when you really look at it in the world, you're accountable for you and only you.
Mm-hmm.
So that whole money, coming back to that whole money thing, like I said, treat people the way you would want to be treated or treat them with the same, just like how Taylor was saying,
mm-hmm.
because money, the value of money, it could change in the blink of an eye.
It inflates and deflates like crazy.
Every single day.
Don't let
that be the premise of how you
mm-hmm.
determine how you would treat someone
yeah.
in a sense. Because
how you look at
there's people, yeah, because there's people that are literally poor and their heart is like made of gold.
Mm-hmm.
They're the kindest people you will ever meet. And then there's rich people that are complete snobs,
mm-hmm.
miserable people. So, like, yeah.
Money doesn't equate to happiness.
Money doesn't equate to anything when you really look at it, because when you die, you leave it here.
It's going to my brother
or
my sister.
Exactly. You leave it here. You can't take it with you. So, yeah.
For you, Sharnae and John, how did you guys feel about the money talk section?
Hello?
I think she's gone again.
Hello?
Oh.
Hello?
Yeah, I was asking you, how did you guys feel about the money talk section?
I
mean, for me, I would say, go ahead.
No, you're good.
Yeah, I was saying for me, I feel like I didn't really get a chance to go over the money talk, but can you just create a question for that part of
the money talk.
The book?
Okay, well, I'll go back to the questions, but Sharnae, go ahead and see how you felt about it, if you were able to read that part.
I guess it's just, you know, just kind of simplifying what it is. I think most times in our lives, we overcomplicate a lot of stuff, and we attach ideologies to different things, and I think with money, that's one of the main things that we've attached a lot of things and overcomplicated because of the power of the money, of
mm-hmm.
money. And so I like how he just kind of simplifies that and just kind of realizing that most people, again, going back to what kind of like I've been saying, they've been taught that if you have money, like, even the rich have been taught, if you keep this money in our family, we can keep the lineage going, we can keep this going. But the poor is taught, if you have money, you have more resources or you have more ability to do stuff and you can have access to stuff. So it's just kind of this consistent race of just wanting to obtain paper. And I love how that's what he said about, like, money is only clamshells or metal discs or scraps of paper, especially now we have our, like, debit cards. Like, that's imaginary. You know, it's not really until you actually take it out the book.
Mm-hmm. You don't burn it?
So, it's kind of dope that even though this book was written so long ago, it still holds so much emphasis, especially now mm-hmm. when it says metal disc. Like, mm-hmm. think about, like, how did he know that we were going to have electronic, like, you know.
Like, money you just have waiting.
Yeah, that's crazy. It's but even, yeah. but, you know.
It's a constant. Yeah. It reminds you ever, Kendrick Lamar, how much a dollar costs? When a Barack Obama it was like in that song he talks about an interaction with a homeless person and how he has millions but he's still not willing to give away and how much a dollar really costs. It's a very prolific song. I love it. But continue. So sorry.
Hmm. No, I'm gonna definitely have to listen to that. I definitely have to listen to that. But no, that was just basically it. Just simplifying that
mm-hmm.
after. And it's funny how he put this at the end of the book. Like, the entire book is about riches and obtaining certain things, but then he puts this like, okay, but it's not that big of a deal. Like, it's not that big. You know, I love that little last minute hook to kind of like keep you humble. I think that's kind of what it was for me subliminally, because I feel like Napoleon Hill is a very subliminal person in certain aspects mm-hmm. of this book. But that was a subliminal message, you know, just to be humble, whether you have the money or whether you don't have the money, you know. And I know that there's this like Bible scripture that says like I finally know the secret, and that's literally the verbiage of the scripture. I know the secret because I've had and I've had not, you know. So basically saying you know how to basically manage, and you know the differences of having certain things and not having certain things, and this just kind of made me think about it that way.
Yeah, that's dope. And I know another principle in this, like, that's why every time we do a blog talk show, we say we're going to do a chapter, and then I turn around and say, hey, nah, we're just going to do parts. Because mm-hmm. the first principle is literally, you can discuss it in so many details and so many ways and so many sections. Like, but from this one section, the one thing I've all, one thing I've noticed.
On my butt.
Okay. One thing he puts is that we kind of carry people who have money on certain pedestals and on certain ideas. Like, I know for me, when I was in middle school, my dad changed the schools that I went to. So I went from Dade County schools to Broward County, and Broward County was like upper middle class and Dade County was middle class. But I noticed that as soon as I got into Broward County schools, where when you think, because this is a higher socioeconomic level, people are supposed to be smarter, they're supposed to, like, be better people, and then you get into the schools and you realize kids are in the sixth grade and don't know their multiplication. Like, we're supposed to be in advanced algebra in the sixth. I was like, for me, math was always my go-to, so I was always advanced in math in school. So I'm in middle school, and I learned my multiplication in the third grade because for some reason, it was like the school I went to, they really honed in on like education. So they like, they sped it up for you. So, but when I went to a higher socioeconomic level or county where the schools are supposed to be better, they're supposed to be better funded. So you expect everything to be like of a higher level, and you go there and it's just great. And kids are still learning their multiplication. It was like, it really put it in perspective to me at such a young age that money don't mean nothing unless you use it. But one thing I got from this book is that you can have money, but just what you do with it also matters, and how you hold it to a certain pedestal. Like, and then one thing I love, especially in the example that he used for the book, was that this man lost his job, so he has no money, and his friends look down on him. The same people that once you had a job with, you were at the same level with, now that you lost your job, now they're looking down on you. So it's kind of like, it makes you self-reflect. Do I look down upon the person next to me for not having money? Do y'all?
No, I don't, because I know what it feels like.
No, I don't. Exactly.
Because I know, like, me and my sister have a twin sibling rivalry. So now that she's like, no, it's real. the good twin and the bad twin, like those polar opposites that people put you up against, especially when you're younger. Like, she was always a lighter twin, so she was always a pretty twin. I'm a darker twin, so I'm the smarter twin. So it's like those polar opposites that people put you at is very negative. So, like, growing up, it's always been a competition. But when my sister, like, lost her job and she stopped working, I, in the beginning, started looking down on her because she didn't have a job. But then, and I will admit it, I was a little B-word to her because I was like, you don't have a job, you don't have money, don't talk to me. You're not a city, you're a city girl. I'm not. Don't talk to me. Thank you. But then I started looking at it, and I looked at how, because she didn't have a job, she was able to bring her grades up in school. She's able to focus on more of what she likes. Like, my sister has actual hobbies. I don't have hobbies. I go to work.
You're busy.
I'm busy all the time. I don't get to go because I go to work. So it's like, at first I look down upon her, but it's just like, money doesn't mean anything. Like, I have money. At the end of the day, you can have money, but as long as, if you don't know how to organize it, you don't have none. I could have $500 and then be broke tomorrow after paying my bills and after spending it on so much other BS. After reading this, I kind of looked at me and my relationship with my sister and how I treated her after she didn't have a job and she stopped earning money herself. And I'm just like, that was really bad in me. So now I work with her and try to help her, like, get, because she wants to be a teacher, so I got help with that. But it's like, I had self-reflecting myself. It's like, do I look at people differently when they don't have a job? And I would like to say that I don't, but I did. I don't now, but I did when it came to my sister. So it's like, we do, as a society, hold people with money to a certain standard, but once you cut the money out, what is it that they really have that you don't have, and vice versa?
Nothing, honestly. Yeah. You're on the same plane.
It's all it is a monetary value. We're all flesh and bones at this point.
Yep. Exactly.
Flesh and bones. But you're skinny. At this point, all right, do you have anything else to add? John and
Trenny. I want to say thank y'all. I really enjoyed this, and I feel like I've been doing myself a disservice for not being as consistent as I should have been, and I apologize for letting fear, one of the fears that we've been talking about, letting my fear just get in the way of this blessing, because I need this. I wish we could do this more often, but I need this, and I needed this today. So thank y'all for being patient with me and still welcoming me and just telling, you know, me about you without you having talked. Just tell me about you. So by just your responses and everything like this, I'm learning about who you guys are and is making this experience of being in my 20s, you know, kind of more, I'm accepting it more because it's not just me. Huh?
People said the 20s are supposed to be fun. This is not fun.
This
is ghetto. This is ghetto.
Because we're different. We're different. We're not like the people in the like, we're not like our family members or, you know.
Yes.
We have a different mentality. Look, we're reading this book. Like, who else is reading this book at our age? And we're on a phone call at 10 o'clock in the morning. Like, who else is doing that? So, of course, it's going to be a little bit more challenging.
Like, dog, I really did my sister dirty for 2 months. I got to call her.
Well, you grow.
Yeah.
You
but,
grow,
yeah, honey, for me, I would just like to say, I'd say thanks again, too, for, you know, just being a part of the show with you guys. I know, like I said, I missed a few weeks. Because, you know, I had some things to deal with on the side. But this show definitely just, you know, gave me a time to think about life. The book really is helpful. And every time I pick it up and read through it, I'm always taken aback, always overwhelmed with the amount of information that inside of it. But, you know, I made a decision that, you know, even if I put it down, I got to always pick it back up because I know, like, the book have the truth. And then one of the things he said, like, in the introduction, he was like, if you don't really want to, you know, base the book off of just making money or generating wealth, you can add another word inside there to replace money. So he said you can use, you know, God as an example. So, you know, I just thought that, you know, the principles are, you know, kind of as it is. You know, it works for anything. So definitely a good book.
What is it called? They have a very good multi-use tool.
Mm-hmm.
Alrighty.
Mm-hmm.
To close out, as a recap, today we discussed the first part of how to outwit the six ghosts of fear. We divided it into two parts because the fear of poverty is just so deep that we can't try to do that one. I'm not going to sit here and think about myself in 15 different ways in 1 hour. I can't do it. I'll go home.
That's what I got over time.
Give me another week. We can talk about that next week. We discussed the first part of how to outwit the six ghosts of fear, that being poverty, criticism, ill health, loss of love of someone, old age, and death. We talked about how fear is one of the thought pulses, too, in that if you let it overwhelm your thought impulses, it will control your creative imagination. It will control your infinite intelligence. It will become physical. And once it becomes physical, it becomes detrimental. We talked about the fear of poverty, and that the fear of poverty is based off what you deem to be riches. Ajua deems dependence as her fear of poverty. Some people have a monetary fear of poverty. My fear of poverty is within yourself spiritually, not physically, but spiritually and mentally, is to have that debilitating factor of like a loss of will and spirit. We discussed how to get through that fear of poverty to determine the riches you seek. Use the philosophies in the first 13 steps of the chapter to demand and command your riches. And then you have to understand where your fear of poverty came from, and to understand that it's the reason why certain things aren't happening to you, because it paralyzes your efforts and it paralyzes your determination. So once you move through that blockage, your heart can pump again at that point. And then you have to realize where it came from. Some of it can come from your family. Some of it can come from your environment. Some of it can come from just inward self-doubt or inward thoughts that you keep letting go and that have gone on for too long. Let's not forget the three enemies discussed in the first part: indecision, doubt, and fear. Fear will lead to indecision. Indecision will lead to doubt, and that is debilitating in itself. And then we also talked about the symptoms of fear: poverty, indifference, indecision, doubt, worry, overcaution, procrastination. And then we discussed last part, money talk. And the topic that we really want to keep to that chapter is understand or look into yourself of what pedestal do you put people who have money, or what pedestal do you put money as a concept as. And so remember that money doesn't make a difference. The only thing that is different between you and the man on the street or the person on the street is a monetary value. But when you take it away, who has more at heart? Who has more intelligence? Who is more fulfilled within themselves? And when you look at that, are you worse or better than the person next to you? Like every discussion we have, I like to leave off with a quote because I'm sentimental. So the quote that I have today is off of page 240, and it's at the bottom in cursive, and it goes, "Fears are nothing more than states of mind, as has been demonstrated repeatedly in the chapters of this book," repeatedly. "One state of mind is subject to control and direction." So as he teaches with creative imagination, as he teaches with infinite intelligence, fear is nothing but a thought, and thoughts can be neglected, thoughts can be controlled. So once you learn to control your thoughts and put it in a positive direction, then your physical equivalent to what you're thinking about, to what you're feeding to your creative imagination, and to what your infinite intelligence is drawing from will produce positive physical action.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you guys. Thank you, Sharnay. Thank you, John. Thank you, Ajua, for having an enlightening discussion with us all. We will see you guys back here next Friday at 9:30 a.m. Have a great day, guys.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah.
See y'all.
Thank you.
See y'all.